Jay Beam and Jay Savitri, everyone. I'm Tenmori Soundarajan, and this is Cast in the United States with First Post. Today's episode is an exploration of caste in the art world. Joining us is internationally renowned curator and artist Jayashree Abhichandani. Her exhibition and her own solo work as an artist has been shown around the world, and she has been one of the first curators to push for Dalit artists to be seen in South Asia, Europe, and the US. Welcome, Jayashree and Jay Beam.
Jay Beam, thank you so much for having me.
Jayashree, you are a well-known figure in the art world, having been everywhere from the Queen's Museum to the Ford Foundation. And you've also been a very vocal advocate for increasing diversity and representation in art. Can you tell us, in your opinion, how does caste play out in these spaces, particularly among South Asians?
So I think it would be very much parallel to how it does in many other fields, right? Which includes access to language, culture, education, context, networks of support, materials even, right? For example, when you're kind of upper caste or you're Brahmin and you're used to being part of the system, you are able to plug into the hierarchies of the art world because they're kind of replicated in the art world the same way they are in society. And you don't quite challenge those hierarchies and you understand how to navigate them to make space for yourself within them. And all of those things are impacted both by caste and by class. And I kind of went through most of the exhibitions, South Asian exhibitions that I had curated in the past. And to be honest with you, until I worked with Tenmori, I was much more focused on being sure that the diversity was there in terms of religion and nationality and queerness and so many, even blackness, but so many other types of representation. It was really like caste was the last thing that was left to be unpicked. And it took a really long time even for me to come to it. And I'm not a Brahmin, I'm just somewhere upper caste, not quite sure where. So the ways in which I understood it to operate, for example, are if we look at the artists, particularly the Indian artists, let's not look at the Pakistani or the Bangladeshi artists who are successful, for whom class is paramount, but within the Indian context, the ones who are most successful tend to be Brahmin. They tend to have gone to private schools and Ivy League art schools, and they have access to the language of the white art world. They have made sure that they're completely well versed in it and they are addressing it and their success depends on it. And in order to be a successful artist in the art world here, as it's construed, you really have to shut your eyes to all kinds of injustices. You cannot look at who's on the board of the museums that you get shown in. If you get shown in any museums at all, you cannot look at who's buying your work because you just need to be able to make it work. So there are all kinds of compromises that you have to be willing to make. And those are, in a way, compromises you're willing to make only if you understand yourself to be part of systems. If you've always been shut out of those systems, those are not compromises that you're willing to make. It also goes to the matter of address, right? Who are you addressing in the art world? Like, there are folks, like I said, who clearly understand that success means addressing the white art world. And so the work that they make is easily legible by those folks. But then there are folks who understand that actually they're going to address who they are or their communities. They're going to address the people that mirror them, whether those people be, you know, people of color or queer or South Asian or Black or whatever it may be, all of the different ways in which we identify intersectionally. So there are those, right? There are those who have committed themselves to, let's call that loving Blackness as opposed to loving whiteness. And the position that you find yourself in, if you commit, like I have, to, you know, promoting and making visible the work of all of the people that are left out of the equation. For example, I'll give you numbers, right? So in US museums, 85.4% of the collected work is by white artists. 87.4% of that is by white men. 9% of the work is by Asian artists, 2.8% by Latino artists, and 1.2% by African American artists. And now when we come to South Asian artists and the numbers of South Asian artists represented in New York galleries, that would be 0.2%. So if out of 100 artists in New York, only 0.2% are South Asian who are successfully showing, I would say the percentage of Dalit artists within that tiny percentage would be kind of invisible.
That's a really an important place to kind of map power as well, Jayashree, because again, even the fact that those statistics exist have to do with the fights for diversity that are led by curators of color. We don't have the same diverse body of curators for South Asian art that can advocate for caste as a critical axis. But imagine if we were able to do that, we could make that argument that, you know, this has been erased and this is a community and a point of view that really needs to be centered as we look at the changing norms and possibilities coming out of the South Asian context.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like, you know, there's so much ignorance and misperceptions about India and what there's so much kind of glorification of Hinduism that I'm just not here for. And it is crucial to have caste be part of the dialogue so that people have a really clear critical understanding of what is happening on the ground these days.
And, you know, some of the question about why it's hard for South Asians and even harder for caste oppressed South Asians to be represented in these spaces is what these spaces represent. They represent such kind of closed door spaces that are elite, that, you know, you need a lot of already existing privilege and access to get into. For me, that brings up the question of like what we fundamentally see as art. You know, for example, people from Dalit Bahujan communities are often working and struggling people. And so their art can be seen as being related to utility, to work, to narrative and struggle. So the art is not in the galleries. It's in the statues of Ambedkar or Periyar on the streets, right? It's in the pots that have been shaped to draw water, or it's in songs about ancestors, or in protest signs or political posters. Now, do you feel that one of the things the art world needs to do is step down from museums and galleries and step onto the streets?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's a very straight equation, see, because the value of art is assigned very arbitrarily by gallery dealers. It depends on exclusivity. It depends a kind of esoteric, you know, community supporting it very much in the ways that Brahmanism works. There's such a kind of direct parallel between the ways in which, you know, caste functions and the way that the art world functions, right? So, because there is the art market, which is very small and very exclusive, and very few people in the art world actually get to be successful artists in that way. But then there are like local initiatives, there's kind of social practice work, which is closer to the work of Dalit artists, which is rooted in the community. There are works that engage socio-political issues. But, you know, the reality is that within the U.S. art world, a very particular kind of art is prioritized. It is an artwork that is very self-referential, that depends on the history of white male art to give itself any value. It is opaque to most other people. And, you know, I spent a long time at the Queen's Museum trying to change that model along with a whole host of people. There was a great director there named Tom Finkelpearl, who went on to become the Commissioner of Cultural Services for New York City, who hired me as someone who lived close to the museum and was a community organizer to bring the communities into the museum. And, you know, we worked for a really long time. We worked for about 10 years to do that work. But then the state intervened, frankly. After Tom left, there was a director named Laura Rajkovic who took up his ideology and was leading the museum. And there was a huge fracas caused by the Israeli government, which basically led to Laura and some of the other staff having to leave the museum. And that amazing trajectory that we set up of the museum being a community space came to a screeching end. And, you know, there are ways in which I have seen, you know, white supremacy in the art world pay lip service to diversity, but punish every single one of us who dedicate our lives doing this work. And I can name at least 3 to 4 Black women curators who within the last year have either come out and spoken about the blatant racism they have faced in their places of work at different museums, and they have either resigned or they have spoken up. And, you know, the fact remains that those of us who are working to shift this art world, there's a lot of backlash for it. There's a lot of ways in which we get punished for it. We get brought into institutions to make those changes, and then those institutions resent us for asking for those changes. And so it's really kind of intense work, because all the museums continue to be led by white people. Their boards are filled with billionaires, and frankly, museums are places where billionaires are money laundering their money and reputation laundering, you know, kind of destructive ways of having made their income. And so there are those of us who have been asking for all of these structural changes within museums, because they're meant to be public institutions that are open to us, that are not reflecting just the interests of billionaires. So it's a very deep fight that we're in right now.
And I think this is really important for our listeners who aren't as familiar with the business of art. But, you know, there can be a really easy mistake where people are assuming that art is just the place for a marketplace of ideas, when rather, art is a place that becomes an artifact of capital by all of these different stakeholders who have money in the game to create a currency around the conversation of the artists that they curate. So all of these different institutions become so critical to examine in terms of the ways that they keep layering and cementing hegemony. So whether it's art schools, like where people learn their craft, or, you know, the curators and the gallery spaces where art is shown and then therefore, you know, given value, to the commerce of the conversation in the global scene. Because again, this is a really interesting moment for art, because we are seeing, you know, the traditional nexuses of art conversations that happen in Delhi and New York also open up to a global conversation, where Shanghai and Singapore, as well as Berlin, are also really clear anchors for what gets to be seen as part of the global conversation. And through that area, South Asian curators are a gatekeeper for what gets to be determined as craft versus what is seen as fine art. And I think this is part of what I want to dig in a little bit with you, Jayashree, is that, you know, as a Dalit artist myself, I think one of the things that I've seen that runs as a current with all of my other Dalit artist colleagues is that our articulation as Dalit Bahujan artists has a different origin story than what is traditionally known as modern art. And I think that when you think of, you know, the Indian style of painting that is associated with Indian nationalism that started the modern art scene in India, it is very much one of Indian nationalism as informed by Brahmins, particularly Bengali Brahmins. And that has really come to shape and dominate who gets to be seen as an authentic voice of the Indian context, whether it's the diaspora or not. And so I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because I think you've seen that, you've been in some of these circles, and how you think it creates a culture of difficulty for Dalit artists like myself who might be trying to navigate this space.
So when I was in going back to Bombay a fair amount in the late 90s and early 2000s, I got to know many of the folks who are the biggest art stars in the Indian art world now. And from what I understood from their experience, while they were in art school, they felt like they had to educate themselves on the language of Western contemporary art, which was not being taught to them. And you see, for them to access what was happening in the rest of the world, they had to have a great degree of privilege in terms of caste, class, education, access to resources, libraries, books, culture, understanding art history in a way that most Dalit artists just would not have access to at all. And it is actually looking at art that was happening in the West that created this new generation of, you know, Indian contemporary artists who are very successful in the market and within the museums and biennial scenes and so on and so forth. But all of that success is completely predicated on their caste and their class and their ability to be able to access these academic discourses of the West, which completely leave out the aesthetics, the philosophies, the symbolism, all of it that is the struggle that is associated with Dalit artists. The reality is that for them to be able to continue to be successful, these artists have to evacuate their work of anything that would piss off the government. And so the work that actually ends up being shown and successful is a very kind of, you know, bland kind of critique that is completely from their upper caste perspective. They, you know, some of the most successful artists are Brahmin artists who can spout like white male theorists like nobody's business. And that's why they're so successful, is because they can speak in the language of white men. And, you know, those are all kinds of things that leave out the voices of all of the people that we are engaging with. You know, I did some reading in terms of the even the iconography that's used by Dalit artists, and I can't speak to it because it was just one essay, but I learned so much about the use of, say, materials, the use of land, the ideas of pollution and not pollution, what the pictorial language being used is, the evacuation of the human figure or the placing of the human figure and how that figure is situated within nature, the use of natural symbology. I mean, there's so much beautiful, rich stuff there. But the truth is that the traditions of Dalit artists are regarded as folk traditions, and they're relegated to a, you know, much smaller monetary value and market, a local market. And very few of those artists are actually able to break out individually into a contemporary art scene that rewards them financially the same way that upper caste artists are rewarded.
And I think that's really important, because I think of my other peers, and I just want to shout them out here, like Malvika Raj and Priyadarshini Oho and Sajan Mani, because there is this like very, you know, powerful movement of Dalit artists who are taking space and are creating opportunities for people to interrogate caste privilege, as well as discuss the pain of what it is to be caste oppressed. And I just feel that this is a moment where, you know, there are a lot of South Asian artists that will be the first to jump on a decolonized conversation, but are much more reticent to talk about what it means to de-Brahmanize. And I think for us as South Asians, the call to de-Brahmanize is even more urgent than the call to decolonize, because it is actually the core wound that continues to divide our society. And it's also what eclipses our ability to really speak to the human condition. Because how can you speak to the human condition if you're excluding, you know, hundreds of millions of people and you're just the creamy layer of society? What point of view do you have to what suffers, what moves, and what really breathes through the heartbeat of our communities? And so I'm just wondering if you might be able, Jayashree, to kind of share some of the successes that you've seen in terms of art, the art world, in terms of diversification with relationship to race, because that might be the pathway for people to think more critically about how to diversify in terms of the issue of caste.
Sure. I also just really want to quickly shout out one or two folks. One is Rajeshree Goody, who is a wonderful Dalit artist and curator. And also, I want to shout out 12 Gates Gallery in Philadelphia, who had shown the work of Anmol Patil, who's a Dalit artist, and they were one of the first folks to do so. So I really want to give props to Atif and Aisha for always keeping that within their conversation, because they are one of the few galleries that actually do pay attention. So I'd want to start with Atif, Aisha, and 12 Gates, and then kind of move on to some of the wins. And I have to tell you that I have to think a wee bit about the wins, because, you know, I just read you the statistics about actually what a small number, 1.2% of the collections of American museums include African American artists. And this is something that, you know, I think a few museums are trying to systematically correct. And there are a few museums who have actually sold the works of older white male artists and used that money to purchase the works of Black Indigenous POC artists, which is great. I want to shout out a very important person. His name is Franklin Sermons. He is the director of the Perez Art Museum in Miami. And, you know, he's a rare Black male director of a museum, and he has made it a mission to really foreground and purchase and collect the work of Black women of color artists and give them the most spectacular shows that we've seen in a long time. There are just the most brilliant Black women curators to whom you know, we are indebted for showing us how this can be done. And they include Thelma Golden, who's the executive director of the Studio Museum, Deborah Willis, who is just a queen. She has been at the forefront of deconstructing Black imagery and giving us the most powerful shows that we can. There are a couple of strategies, right? So one is like intervening within institutions. Now, that is a problematic enough strategy because it takes a lot of personal, it takes from you personally to be surrounded by a sea of whiteness and to do this change. But then the other strategy is to actually build those spaces and those institutions where we are centralized, right? So like Thelma Golden set up the Studio Museum in Harlem, there are those folks who have been actively engaged in setting up structures, support structures for Black, Indigenous people of color, artists. And those are the structures that hold us up. You know, there's an organization called Enfoco, which has been working with photographers of color. And they're the best archive of the kind of work that has been produced by photographers here. So even though these spaces are smaller, their function is absolutely critical because they become the repositories of these communities' histories in a way that we cannot depend on mainstream arts institutions to do. So the work of actually building these organizations is critical. And so those are some of the strategies. And then the other strategies include, like, you know, curating in a way that's sensitive and bringing community in through public programming. There are just so many ways in which you can engage a dialogue, even with all of the restrictions that may be placed on us.
I also think that there has to be an investment in Dalit artists and caste oppressed artists in general. And that includes investments throughout the entire ecosystem of their career. So whether it's scholarships at art schools, money for materials, fellowships so that people can really build both their arts practice and their arts thinking, and then the ability to have support for their first show. Like, I have been in touch with a lot of Dalit artists who, you know, maybe have had the opportunity to be curated, you know, abroad, but they don't have the money to attend their own show. And being able to be present when your work is being exhibited is so critical to the networking and the relationship building and also the feedback loop you need as a creator to be able to know that your work is impactful and that you're being seen. And I also think another really critical lens which we are missing is the role of criticism. And, you know, as a filmmaker, I know that, you know, we would not have seen the rise of new wave cinema if we didn't have the Arthur sales, right? And if we didn't have the accompanying criticism that helped to make meaning around the objects that were being created by those innovators. And I think similarly, we really lack a body of artistic criticism that really has Dalit Bahujan-centered critics who can be able to speak to this moment and to speak to these creators. And so I'm just wondering, like, have you seen other efforts that have been invested in that could help build that platform?
Right. So I'll give you a really well-known example in American art, which is Project Row Houses. Project Row Houses is based in the Third Ward in Houston, Texas, which was a historically Black ward. And there's an artist named Rick Lowe, who is the founder of Project Row Houses, and he was a contemporary artist working in his studio. And at some point, whilst he was working in his studio, a young man came into his studio and said, well, what is the point of the art that you're making if you say it's for the community, but it does nothing for the community? And so that really spurred Rick into action. And so he got involved with community organizing efforts within his neighborhood, within the Third Ward. And there was a row of 22 what are called shotgun houses. And these are houses that were slave quarters, essentially. And those houses were slated for demolition. And so what happened is that Rick and the entire community got together and they prevented the demolition of these houses and they took them over and they turned them into a dual purpose nonprofit organization. And half of them ended up being dedicated to artists, where each house was given to an artist to create work. And the rest of the houses, each house was given to a single mother. And what was done is that she wasn't just provided with housing. She was provided vocational training, educational training. She could go to college. She got daycare. She got, you know, food. She lived in this community with other single mothers as long as she needed. to get on her own feet and then move on. In the meanwhile, there were international artists who were coming in or local artists who were coming in and occupying these homes. And there's been, for the entire life of Project Row Houses, this amazing dialogue and the agency that they feel, because along with Project Row Houses, they are the ones who get to decide some of what happens, what the zoning regulations are, what places get preserved, how to protect themselves against gentrifiers. And it gives them a kind of organizing power that a lot of communities in their neighborhoods lack.
So Jayshree, thank you so much for this very rich conversation. Would you have any last thoughts that you'd like to share with everyone?
Well, I think one of the questions that you guys had was about, you know, what would be my ask for other upper caste folks like myself? And so I've been thinking a lot about my own process of coming to a place of, you know, wanting caste abolition and giving up Hinduism. And I would say to the folks who are my peers is that us in the diaspora have the privilege to be able to do this. And if we do not do this work, it is our biggest failure. And I'm going to quote Dr. Ambedkar, and where he says, "I shall have no faith in Rama and Krishna, who are believed to be incarnation of God, nor shall I worship them. I thereby reject my old religion, Hinduism, which is detrimental to the prosperity of humankind and which discriminates between man and man, and which treats me as inferior." So, you know, I would just encourage all of them to, you know, just acknowledge their privilege and come to a place of working with it and being cognizant and opening up the spaces that they occupy to Dalit folks.
And also, I think that piece about listening is something else that another one of our previous guests spoke to, is that it is very hard for dominant caste people who are trained to center themselves to decenter themselves. Even when they decenter themselves, they are still recentering themselves. And so sometimes it's just about taking a pause, both in terms of practice and in process, to be able to find new ways of creating and curating and building conversations and community. And that's really a lot of what I heard in the Row House example, is that when a community drives its own representation, the sites of art completely change, as well as our points of view and the conversations that might potentially come out of it. And so sometimes there's a real act of courage we have to take as a field to say, what's happening right now is not working. We need to experiment, and we need to try, and we need to have investments in those experiments, because artists really are the dreamers that create the world that can be. And I really, you know, we know that caste exists across so many different faiths at this point. And so our goal now is to look at, what does it take to create a society free of caste? What kinds of dreams do we need to have? And who are the dreamers that are helping us walk towards that? And I think that's the potential of liberatory curation, that it's intercaste and interfaith, with the centering of artists that have never had the national or even global table around these issues. And so I hope that that's stuff that we can continue to build and be in conversation around, Jayshree, because I know that you have been really an important person who's been intervening to lifting up more caste oppressed voices. And so with that work, we really want to thank you. And also thank you for joining us today.
I am just always in love with the work you do and the wisdom and clarity with which you bring your perspective to us. And I'm just really humbled and honored to be here with you. I have to tell you that you are women that I look up to every single day to just strengthen my own moral compass. You know, you're incredible.
You know, art doesn't shy away from controversy. And I think as communities that are South Asian, we have legacies of genocide, we have legacies of caste apartheid, we have legacies of gender-based violence. And it's important that instead of hiding them or silencing them, we need to lean into them with compassion and empathy, but also very deep insight from those that can speak to that violence most closely. And when we look at that lens through the visionary, we actually see that, you know, what would have extinguished millions of voices could actually allow for millions of voices to now bloom. And that's really the power of art. I just, you know, really want to thank you again for joining us. And we look forward to your next exhibition and your next show, and look forward to having you on again in the future. So thank you. And we want to thank all of our listeners who are listening online, and we look forward to bringing you on for our next episode. And until then, J Beam and J Salvatore.
J Beam.